Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Alice Bryant, Anna Mateo, and Jonathan Evans. Later, Katie Weaver and Anne Ball have a special report on one of America's national treasures. But first, this report. Most college students in the United States choose their major or main field of study for their degree before or during their first year. For Saskia Fagan, making that choice was not easy. Fagan, who is now 31 years old, grew up in Tacoma Park, Maryland. From an early age, she loved animals. So when she began studying at Frostburg State University in Frostburg, Maryland in 2004, she expected to become a dog trainer. However, Frostburg State did not offer any degree programs related to dog training. Fagan chose to study psychology instead. A few months later, she changed her major to biology. But then she decided she did not want to spend her life working in a laboratory. In her second year, she changed majors to another field of interest, fine art.
After 2 years of studying fine art, however, Fagan felt that she preferred art as something she did for pleasure, not for work. So she made one final change into a field called liberal studies. That field let her design a major based around a mix of different subjects. Fagan finally completed her degree program in 2011, 7 years after she had started. The cost of adding extra time to earn a degree created some problems, she says. But, she adds, taking the time to find the perfect field also helped lead her to a career she has found very satisfying. Fagan is now a map designer. It's really important to know what you don't want to do, she told VOA. If anything, those are great learning experiences too, whether that's a major that you tried and didn't like, or a job that you had for a year and you thought, this is not for me. If anything, those are just as valuable as knowing what path you want. Fagan's experience is common in American higher education. About one-third of college students in the U.S. change majors at least once. And many who do so began in science, technology, engineering, and math, in other words, STEM fields.
In December, the U.S. Department of Education's National Center for Education Statistics released a study on students who changed majors. The study looked at 25,000 college students who entered into degree programs for the first time in 2011. By 2014, about 1 in 3 first-time students seeking bachelor's degrees changed majors. 1 in 10 changed majors more than once. In addition, the study found that students in STEM fields are about 6% more likely to change majors than non-STEM students. Tracy Hunt White is one of the researchers who worked on the study. She points out that an earlier study found about one-third of STEM students who changed majors left the STEM fields completely. They chose non-STEM-related majors instead. The most recent study found that students who start in mathematics are the most likely to change, with 52% choosing another field. Hunt White says she could not comment on the reasons students make these changes, but National Science Teachers Association Executive Director David Evans says he might have some idea why. He says the reason may be, in large part, due to the differences in teaching styles of STEM educators at the high school and university levels.
High school math and science classes are often much smaller than they are at colleges and universities. So the students often feel they have a more personal connection to the subjects they are studying, and therefore their teachers as well, he says. And, Evans says, many professors feel college-level STEM classes should be difficult enough to make some students want to leave those fields. There's sort of a historic culture, oftentimes in university education, especially in science and math, to think of the early courses as being screening courses where the idea is you find out which students are good enough to get through those courses, he told VOA. And so instead of being an educational regime that encourages students, it's one that really filters. Evans argues that as technology becomes a bigger part of everyday life, it is going to be only more important to understand STEM-related subjects. He says that, as a result, educators will have to learn to be more inclusive. Also, they will need to find ways to make the material they are teaching more relatable. Another big difference between high school and college-level STEM education is the way the material is covered, Evans says. Once students enter the college level in mathematics, for example, they face much more abstract ideas. Evans suggests that college professors do not always do the best job of explaining how students will use these ideas in real-world situations.
Also, he says, many college STEM courses test students on how well they remember these complex ideas, not how well they understand them. The National Science Teachers Association released a series of suggestions for STEM teachers 5 years ago. They are for teachers at every level and discuss how to address the issues that Evans suggests make STEM fields so discouraging. Many STEM educators across the United States have begun to follow these suggestions, he says. The goal is to make sure that plenty of Americans stay in these fields throughout their entire education. There's no single thing that we could do, with one possible exception, he said. And that is, I think that if we could do something that would allow for more time to be spent on STEM courses for elementary school children, that might actually make a big difference. Not everyone who majors in a STEM field in college goes on to work in that field. Yet, Evans feels that if they start their STEM education early enough, that might keep students like Fagan interested as they progress. Then they can bring much-needed STEM knowledge along with them on whatever career path they take. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
And now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. Cold weather has a great effect on how our minds and our bodies work. Perhaps that is why we have so many expressions that combine the word cold with body parts. The most straightforward example is the adjective cold-hearted. Just as it sounds, a cold-hearted person is distant and, well, cold. An action can be cold-hearted as well. This would be one that shows no love or sympathy. There are many songs about cold-hearted men or cold-hearted women who, without feeling, broke the hearts of their lovers. In the 1988 song, Cold Hearted, Paula Abdul sings about the cold-hearted man who broke her heart. The song was a huge hit. It seems a trend may have been set. In 2010, the Zac Brown Band released a song with the exact same name.
But in that worst covered your dark and crooked heart, with a forked tongue I fell in love, then I fell apart. You are so cold hearted.
Other similar adjectives often get a hyphen, like cold-blooded. Reptiles, amphibians, and most fish are cold-blooded animals. This means they are unable to control their own body temperature. Mammals, on the other hand, are warm-blooded. Well, for the most part. There are some people in the world you could call cold-blooded. People who show no emotions or feelings are often described as cold-blooded. Cold-blooded people are hard to get close to, and they often do terrible things on purpose. For example, the police might look for someone they call a cold-blooded killer. The person killed someone without any understandable cause, not in self-defense, fear, or even anger. Killing for no reason is often called cold-blooded. Okay, enough of cold-blooded people. Let's go back to fish. As we said earlier, most are cold-blooded. So calling a striped bass or rainbow trout a cold fish is fine. They would not be insulted if they could be insulted. But calling a person a cold fish is an insult. A cold fish is a person who is unfriendly, unemotional, and shows no love or warmth. Cold fish do not offer much of themselves to anyone. However, not everyone who doesn't show their feelings is a cold fish. Some people keep their feelings to themselves until they know you better. We could describe these people with the expression, cold hands, warm heart. This means that a person may be very kind and warm, but they just don't show their feelings very easily. Take my friend Celeste as an example. She doesn't normally show her feelings, but she is always ready to help and is very kind. She is a classic case of cold hands, warm heart. Speaking of hands, the hands and feet are some of the first body parts to feel the cold. Getting cold feet is no fun, outdoors or in conversation. To get cold feet means to become afraid to do something you had already decided to do. We use this expression in situations that make us nervous or afraid, from leading a big meeting at work to singing on stage in front of strangers. But we commonly use it in connection with weddings. People who are about to get married may begin to feel nervous as the day nears. They begin to question if they should take such a big step. If a bride shares these feelings of nervousness and uncertainty, a relative or friend might answer with, "Don't worry, this is a classic case of cold feet." Another body part involved in our cold expressions today is the shoulder. You give someone the cold shoulder when you refuse to speak to them. You ignore them. The expression probably comes from the physical act of turning your back towards someone. You may give a cold shoulder to a friend who has broken a promise, or to someone who has said mean things about others. Well, that brings us to the end of this Words and Their Stories. I'm Anna Mateo.
A memory from your lonesome past keeps us so far apart. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart?
Gun violence is a reality of American life. Across the country, at least 12 people were shot to death on the first day of 2018. A shooting can happen anywhere, in homes, businesses, on the street, and in schools. There were 9 school shootings in the United States in 2017. They left 15 people dead and 18 others wounded. Now, a new simulation program is designed to help keep teachers and students safe from a shooter. The program is like a million other video games available. But this one is not really a game. It is meant to let the user experience what happens when a gunman enters a school. This simulation is difficult to watch, but the programmers say it can save lives. The simulator is a project of the United States Army and Department of Homeland Security. The program is available through an online training program called EDGE. That is short for the Enhanced Dynamic Geosocial Environment. Bob Walker works as EDGE project manager. He says the simulation lets teachers choose and test several plans of action for dealing with a gunman. Walker provided an example. The mass shooting at the Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University in 2007. 32 students and teachers died in the attack. Some Virginia Tech teachers found setting up barriers behind doors worked very well.
So this gives different school districts the ability to try out different things, see what works for their given environment.
The goal is to give teachers, administrators, and even police a chance to virtually walk through an active shooter event at a school. Tamara Griffith works at the Army Research Laboratory.
So experience builds survivability. The more experience you have, the better your chances of survival are.
Griffith adds that the simulation helps users prepare for an attack. She says they can have different experiences and see what works and what doesn't work. Griffith helped to develop the simulator. She says creating the program was difficult for everyone involved. She says the group sat down and listened to police dispatch tapes from earlier shootings. She says they were frightened when they thought about what was happening during those attacks. But their goal was to better prepare law enforcement officers and others who have to deal with shootings. The shooters, children, and administrator in the game operate using artificial intelligence. This enables the programmers to test different safety methods to see how they work. The simulation is shocking and unpleasant, but the programmers say they are doing their best to prepare teachers for the worst that might happen. Tamara Griffith agrees.
We can prevent a lot of these deaths. We can prepare people better. We can make this a safer environment if we can get this into the hands of the right people.
The program is already being used to train some emergency crews in the United States. The Army Research Lab plans to make a school version available soon, without cost to users. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Today, on our National Parks Journey, we explore the Everglades in South Florida. When many people think of Florida, images of sandy coasts, theme parks, and rocket launches come to mind. But it is also home to a natural wilderness different from any other in the United States. Everglades National Park is the largest subtropical wilderness in the U.S. Several rare and endangered species live in the park. It is a huge place, covering more than 600,000 hectares of wetlands. It is also a popular park. More than 1 million visitors pass through the official entrances every year. But others enter the park on water and go uncounted.
In 1947, President Harry Truman spoke at the official opening of Everglades National Park. He said, "The goal of creating the park was to protect forever a wild area that could never be replaced." The Everglades is considered one of the biological wonders of the world. It is a place where plants and animals from the Caribbean Sea share an ecosystem with native North American species. 9 different environments exist within the Everglades. They include mangrove and cypress swamps, estuaries, and coastal marshes.
In the 1940s, reporter and environmentalist Marjorie Stoneman Douglas wrote a book called The Everglades, River of Grass. She described the area as the liquid heart of Florida. Everglades National Park was created to protect an ecosystem from damage. The Everglades is home to about 30 species that federal officials say are threatened or endangered. They include the Florida panther, the American crocodile, and the West Indian manatee. More than 350 bird species and 300 species of fresh and saltwater fish live within the park. The Everglades is also home to 40 species of mammals and 50 reptile species.
Visitors to the Everglades will see many exotic plants. They include what is said to be the largest growth of mangrove trees in the Western world. Gumbo limbo trees, known for their peeling red skin. Strangler figs and royal palms are also among the area's plant life. The country's largest living mahogany tree also lives in the Everglades. Sawgrass grows in some areas of the park. Be careful. Sawgrass is very sharp, with teeth just like a saw. It can grow up to 4 meters tall. With about 1.5 meters of rainfall each year, plants and trees never stop growing in the Everglades. The dry winter season is the favorite of most visitors, when insects like mosquitoes are less of a problem. The rainy season lasts from June to November.
There are many ways to explore the Everglades. Visitors can see alligators while hiking the Anhinga Trail. The park is one of the only places in the world where freshwater alligators and saltwater crocodiles live in the same area. Visitors using canoes are likely to observe large groups of wading birds, like the wood stork or the great blue heron. Bright pink flamingos also thrive in the Everglades. Some visitors might enjoy riding bicycles through Shark Valley. Others might want to take it more slowly. The boardwalk walking trail goes right over the slow-moving water. Visitors can take a close look at insects and other wildlife. The park also offers tram rides for guided tours.
The National Park Service says that early colonial settlers and land developers believed the Everglades had little value. The settlers had plans to remove water from the area. In the 1880s, developers began digging canals to reduce water levels. At the time, they did not understand the complexity of the Everglades ecosystem. As a result, they were not prepared for all the work. They caused environmental problems. Larger efforts to drain the wetlands continued between 1905 and 1910. Farms were built on large pieces of land. More people began to move to the Everglades. More changes came mid-century. The federal government built roads, canals, and water control systems throughout South Florida. The project was aimed at providing water and flood protection for people and farms. Workers built a huge system of waterways and pumping stations to control the overflow of Lake Okeechobee north of the Everglades.
In more recent years, environmental experts learned about the damage to the Everglades. Some experts say the balance of nature in the area has been destroyed. Today, some of South Florida's early wetland areas no longer exist. Populations of wading birds have been reduced by 90%. Whole populations of animals are in danger of disappearing. In 2000, Congress approved a plan to restore and improve the Everglades. Federal, state, and other organizations are partners in the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan. The future is not clear for the wild and beautiful Everglades, but efforts are underway to protect this biological treasure. The hope is that people may continue to visit the extraordinary Everglades National Park long into the future. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Ann Ball.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.